This is day six at the 56th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother Ron Hoban on Dirt to Diamonds. The subtitle for today is Treasures of Jericho. This is the fifth talk in his series, and the introductory reading was Matthew 13, verses 24 to 25. Thanks, Brother Ronald.
Thank you, Ronald. You are a very wise ruler. Which is the meaning of the name Ronald, if anybody didn't know. Possibly. Good morning, everybody. See if we can get this going. Voila. All right. So what we're going to look at this morning is, again, following on from our theme of Dust to Diamonds, we're going to, again, emphasize this idea that we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power might be of God. And what we're going to do today is actually kind of look at a couple of amazing examples of this. I think it's really interesting when we were listening to, you know, the stories of Agape in action and the examples that were given of Agape in action. I imagine there's like thousands and thousands of examples, really good examples of, you know, the effect that Agape in action has had in these countries. But the examples that were used were really, really good examples and were able to demonstrate, you know, the power of change through the work of Agape in action. Now, that's what God does with the examples he uses in the Bible. There's thousands and thousands of examples that he could have used, particularly in and around the preaching of Jesus, but the ones he chose demonstrate this principle really well. And God loves to show the ones where he can take the worst and make the best. So he likes to demonstrate this power so it can show his glory and that it's his work that can make this change. So we read in this record in Matthew chapter 13 the story of this parable. And this is the parable about the hidden treasure in Matthew chapter 13 verse 44. Pretty quick sort of parable, only really last one verse. The kingdom of heaven is like unto a treasure hidden in a field, that when a person finds what's hid, because of joy, he sells all that he has and bought the field. And we want to kind of spin the cube on perhaps what we might have seen as a traditional view of this parable. Because when you look at it at surface level, this parable doesn't actually teach very good morals. I mean, you think about it, like a modern day, what you've got is somebody who's trespassing on somebody else's field without a permit. He's got a metal detector out there, and he's in search of treasure. And when he finds the treasure, he sneakily goes and hides it in another place in the field, goes and sells everything he has so that he can buy the field, so he can acquire this treasure that he found in somebody else's property. Now, I don't know about you, but we would kind of demonstrate that as what you might consider to be either a pirate or maybe a banker, which tends to go into your field, take your treasure, and put it into another place and siphon it off. So there must be a better explanation of this principle of the man and the field and the treasure that Jesus is teaching. Because I really don't think that Jesus is teaching, you know, little children to become pirates. And the answer really comes within the parable that he had just told. So if we go back to Matthew chapter 13 and have a look at the previous parable, and he goes into a detailed explanation of the previous parable of the man that sowed wheat in his field. And in that story, we find that somebody else comes along and sows tears in the same field. And the explanation is given. The field that has been spoken of is the world in the example in the previous parable. And the good seed is the good seed that's chosen, and the bad seed is that which is sown by the devil, the wicked one. Then it goes on and it says, the landowner's slaves come to the owner of the field and say, Master, didn't you sow good seed in your field? So this is more specific now, because we see the field is actually God's field in the previous parable. Now, if we take that same lesson and apply it to the next parable, it becomes quite powerful. Because a man comes along and he's in search of treasure in God's field. And he finds treasure in God's field. And when he finds that treasure, he goes away and sells everything he has in order to purchase the field. And then he takes the treasure out of that field and he puts it in a special place to preserve it. You know, John chapter 1 verse 10 says Jesus came into the world and the world did not know him. But to everyone that did know him, he gave power to become sons of God. He came into the world, the Jewish world, in search of treasure. And then it says, of course, in John chapter 3 verse 16 that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. He sold everything he had in order to purchase the world to save the few, that whoever believes on him. And this is the story exactly of what we learn about the hidden manna. We looked at it. You know, our lives, we have died and our lives are hid. He's taken this treasure and he goes and hides it in a special place. See, that story in the parable of Matthew chapter 13 was about the impending judgment of what was going to happen in AD 70. The story of the wheat and tears was God's judgment that was going to come upon the nation. But the next parable is out of that, Jesus is going to save out of that generation special treasures to be preserved against the day of judgment. And so the story of the manna, the dew, the pearl are all these things that are hidden and closed and protected and buried under the earth like hidden treasure, waiting for the day of their revealing. So that's very interesting, but there's another reason why I think that's the best explanation of the parable, because it actually comes from an Old Testament prophecy. This is, in fact, exactly what God did with Israel. So come and have a look at Ezekiel chapter 16 with me. Not in detail, because Ezekiel chapter 16 is very long and very graphic. So we don't want to get too much down into looking at Ezekiel chapter 16 this morning. But Ezekiel chapter 16 is the story about God's relationship with the nation of Israel. And it says in Ezekiel chapter 16 that he found Israel like an unwanted child, like a child that had been given birth and it was thrown into an open field and no one cared about this unwanted child. No one cared enough about you to do these things to you. You were thrown into an open field because you were despised on the day of your birth. And so here's God walking along an open field and there's a baby lying there. That's the graphic nature of it. Nobody wants it. It's all covered in yuck. Nobody wanted that child. And God says he took that child and he says, I made you flourish like a plant in the field. Ah, doesn't that sound like a parable we've just been reading? I took you and I made you flourish like a plant in the field, and you grew up tall and arrived at your full adornment. And then it says, and then I adorned you with gold and with silver and with clothing of fine linen and silk. I embroidered your cloth. You ate fine wine fine flour and oil and honey. You grew up exceedingly beautiful and advanced in royalty. Ezekiel chapter 19. You shall become my peculiar treasure unto me above all the people, for the world is mine. I'm the owner of the field. I select you. I chose you. I saw you as my peculiar treasure. So that's what happens to Israel. So Jesus is only doing exactly what his father did, didn't he? This whole parable is right there in Ezekiel chapter 16. This is identical to the story of the parable of the man who goes and finds treasure in the field. The tragedy of Ezekiel chapter 16, though, is, of course, the nation, as it grew in wealth and as it grew in power, it started to interact with the other nations. It started to turn away from God. And then it tells you the story of Jerusalem, the adulteress. And this adulteress, Jerusalem, specifically in Ezekiel chapter 16, descends lower and lower and lower. And God says she's worse than a harlot because she doesn't take money for her services. She offers it freely, and he actually specifically calls her the adulteress. And the punishment on the adulteress is really clear. They will bring a mob against you to stone you. So that's what God's judgment upon Jerusalem. I will bring a mob against you to stone you. And, it says in Ezekiel, they shall put you to open shame, and your nakedness will be revealed before everybody, before all your lovers. And then it says, and you must bear the consequences of this evil you have done, and the indecency of your detestable practices. It's the Lord's declaration. But the end of the chapter ends with this. Despite all of this, when you are brought to an open shame, and when you go through this hideous experience, I will establish my covenant with you. I will be compassionate with you. And everyone will know that I am Yahweh, because I will make an atonement for you. Do you know there's this incredible story, isn't there, in the story of John chapter 7, where this is exactly the story of a woman which is brought publicly in Jerusalem by the rulers and the elders of the people to an open shame. She is caught in the very act of adultery. And a mob is brought this woman, and they place her in front of Jesus, and they said, Moses in the law said, stone her. So the mob is brought against her with one intention, that Jesus might condemn her and stone her. And then, of course, instead, Jesus does this incredible thing in this site where he bends down and he writes in the dust. And there is a lot of speculation about what Jesus might have written in the dust. But whatever he wrote in the dust, when he looked up and said the words, he that is without sin, cast the first stone, the consequences of what he had written and what he said caused every man to go out from him in a specific order. Which is kind of odd, isn't it? It said they went out from the eldest to the youngest, didn't it? They moved out in order of age. Doesn't that sound strange? Why did that happen? Well, I have a theory of what Jesus wrote in the dust. And bear in mind, this is a theory, because we don't know. And I know you've all got suggestions. I can assure you they are all hypotheses. But mine's the best.
I
So let me see if I can take you to where I think the background of this is. Jeremiah chapter 17, because I think this is a very interesting chapter. Jeremiah chapter 17. So, some key verses leading into the key verse that I want to look at. Verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. I, the Lord, search the heart and I test the name. This was the most deceitful and despicable act this mob had done in bringing this woman before Jesus, because it was a complete setup. Both partners should have been brought under the law. Obviously, they didn't bring the other partner because it was a complete setup right from the start. It was evil at the core. And they were doing this because there was one man who was standing before them and they had done an investigation. And the man standing before them had a background where Mary gave birth under dubious circumstances and could be accused of committing adultery. Remember, Joseph was not willing to put her away privately. He could have enacted the hideous law of Numbers chapter 5, but he didn't. So this was a trap against Jesus, because if Jesus turns around and said, yes, she should be stoned, they could have said, maybe we should get your mother and bring her here as well. How evil that was. Later on in the chapter, they said, oh, say we not well that you are born of fornication? We're not born of fornication. Say we not well that you're a Samaritan? So they were very evil in this thing. And it says, the heart of man is desperately sick. Then it says, verse 13, O Lord, the hope of Israel, all they who forsake you shall be put to shame. Those who turn away from you shall be written in the earth, for they have forsaken the earth, the fountain of living water. And here's the story where Jesus writes in the earth. Now, I have this theory that he wrote their names in order. How condemning if he suddenly turned around and stood and says, which of you? Pointed to the ground. Did I get it right? Just checking. Steve, have I got you in the right order? Which of you, being innocent, should cast the first stone? And they went out perfectly in order from the first to the last. But then the most beautiful thing happens, isn't it? He stays there, she stays there. She could have snuck away, she could have hidden away. She's there in the most embarrassing situation you could ever imagine. She was guilty of sin, not a question about it. Not a question about it. She was caught in the very act. But she stayed there. And this is the story of Jeremiah chapter 17, and as Ezekiel chapter 16. Look at verse 14. Heal me, Lord. I shall be healed. Save me. I shall be saved. And then verse 16, I have not run away from being your shepherd. I have not run away from being shepherd. Verse 17, be not a terror unto me. You are my refuge in the day of my disaster. Let those who put me to shame and persecute me be persecuted, but don't let me be put to shame. Let them be dismayed, but not me. And Jesus said to the woman, where are your accusers? Does no man condemn thee? She says, no man, Lord. And he said, neither do I condemn thee. And her name is going to be written in stone. I'm sure of it. This story, of course, with the breastplate, when they wrote the names on the breastplate, they wrote them by order of birth on the breastplate, written in stone. Jeremiah says their names shall be written in dirt, and they went out from the eldest to the youngest. Their names are written in dirt. But her name, as she waited and stayed there, is going to be written in stone. What a gem of Jericho. Oh, it was Jerusalem. I've got the wrong title. It should have been Gems of Jerusalem. Hang on. Let's just take a little closer look. John chapter 8. The throwaway verse in this little section. I've got to find it. Someone can find it for me. Where he was. I can't see it. It's not jumping out. Oh, there it is. Sorry.
Verse 20.
So all of these events, and exactly what is happening right here, has a specific location. It's not just in the temple. These events which took place where this woman was brought and accused is given a specific location. And it says, and these words he spoke when he was in the treasury, as he taught in the temple. As he spoke in the treasury. Here was what was called the court of the woman. Or the treasury, because this was the area where the woman would gather. But John makes specific reference. He doesn't call it the court of the woman, he calls it the treasury. Because around, of course, this court were all of these, the trumpets, where they would toss the coins. And of course, later Jesus would talk about this other woman who cast in into the trumpet these coins. And there's Lane Ripmeyer's reconstruction of it, these brass trumpets which would make all the noise as they threw in the money. And it specifically says that where this event happened was in the treasury. It wants you to know that. You know, the only Old Testament specific reference to the treasury, anyone know where it comes from? Joshua. Very good, sorry. Joshua. In relationship to the tabernacle, I should say. In the story of Joshua, it's the story of when they went into Jericho. And so what happens in Jericho, in Joshua chapter 6, note this. When they went into Jericho, they burned up the city and took everything in it, and they put the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron in the treasury of the Lord's house and spared Rahab the harlot, the prostitute, and her father's house. You see that? She is numbered amongst the gems of Jericho that are taken out to be placed in the treasury in the house of God. A prostitute. A harlot. And God plucks out this woman. She's always called Rahab the harlot because God can reach down into Jericho and take the worst of the worst, and he has the ability to bring it into the treasury, and she's brought into the house of God. And that story in John chapter 7 is an amazing example of all these religious leaders who brought this woman caught in the very act of adultery. Was she guilty? Yes. Was she a sinner? Yes. The compassion of Jesus is he's going to take her and she will be part of the gems that the Lord will make up. So what's interesting about this parable of Jericho and Jerusalem is like when you look at Jerusalem and Jericho, it features as a major parable. Jericho, of course, was the oldest city that in history. It's the oldest city in the world. It's the first city ever conquered. And it's it was deemed to be, you know, impregnable. It was powerful and mighty. But of course, we know the story. And the key is that when the city fell down, it says the wall fell down, and it makes this emphasis that the wall fell down flat, completely flat. God totally, we might say one stone was not left upon another. Might be another way to say that. The wall came down and there was one stone not left upon another.
He flattened it.
That's the idea behind the story of Jericho. And when you look at Jericho versus Jerusalem, Jericho's way down there. It's the lowest place on the planet. It's the lowest city. It's on the depth One might say it's in hell because it's below sea level. You go underground to get to Jericho. It's 800 feet below sea level. And then you rise up to Jerusalem, up to the tops and the heights of Mount Zion, which sit 2,500 feet above sea level. So no wonder it says, you know, the parable of the man that went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. You do go down. That's true. You're going straight down into Jericho. So Jericho was, you know, right at the bottom. But out of Jericho, oh man, there's some amazing stuff that comes out of the Dead Sea. Because it's the right next to the Dead Sea. And this city here is the resource for some of the greatest minerals and crystals that are found on the planet and used for healing. So they have Dead Sea salts and Dead Sea minerals, and you can go and spend an absolute fortune when you go over there and buy all of this stuff, which is going to make you younger and live longer. So this is the place of life. Crazy, isn't it? You go to the Dead Sea to try to get younger. Kind of a ironic thing when you think about it, isn't it? You're going to buy everything that comes from the Dead Sea to try to make yourself look better. Now, what's interesting in this story, when Jesus went up to Jerusalem for the last time, his last public event, he deliberately, specifically, went to Jericho first. His journey went deliberately first to Jericho and then straight to Jerusalem. So he starts at the bottom of Jericho. And when he gets to Jericho, of course, he finds this guy in Jericho. Luke chapter 19, he goes into Jericho and he walks in there, and up a tree, sycamore fig tree it is, up this sycamore fig tree is this guy, Zacchaeus. And he says, Zacchaeus, I want to come to your place for dinner. They go and have dinner together, have fellowship. And then Zacchaeus is just blown away with Jesus' presence. And he says, look, I'll give half my goods to the poor. And if I've wronged any man, I'll pay him back fourfold. So this is a man which just, like, he was so moved by Jesus' appearance there. And Jesus says to him, Zacchaeus, salvation's come into your house because you are a son of Abraham. And there's a sycamore fig, by the way. I might call it like a wild fig tree. But when Jesus went and looked up on that fig tree down in Jericho, there was a big, fat, juicy, plump fig ripe for the picking. And Jesus plucked it, took it to his house and had dinner with him. As he went out of the city, there's this other guy, blind Bartimaeus. So he's going out of the city and he heals another guy, blind Bartimaeus, and this guy crying out, son of David, son of David, son of David, son of David. So we've got one guy who's calling Jesus the son of Abraham, or is being called the son of Abraham, and another guy saying, son of David, son of David, son of David, and finally Jesus heals him, and you get this beautiful picture. But what's interesting about these two is it tells the parable just in their words. Bartimaeus means religiously defiled. Something which is polluted, like religiously. Zacchaeus means something which is purified, something which is made pure. So he goes down into Jericho and he finds these people that are religiously defiled, as far as the law is concerned, tax collector and a blind man, and he purifies them. And then it says that Bartimaeus throws off his cloak, sprang up and followed Jesus. And they go up to Jerusalem, and they get to Jerusalem, and everybody throws off their cloaks. And they start shouting. Psalm 118, Hosanna to the Son of David! Hosanna in the highest! And they're shouting and shouting, screaming as they're all laying down their cloaks for Jesus to come into Jerusalem. And the religious leaders said what? Shush! Shush! You're in the temple. You're coming close to the temple. You're not allowed to have that noise. Tell them to be quiet. And Jesus says, if they are quiet, these very stones will start screaming out. You know, he's brought with him up to Jerusalem some stones from Jericho, because along with him is following him is blind Bartimaeus. This is one of the Dead Sea Stones. You know what? That's what they did when they came into Jericho. They took 12 stones out of the Jordan down there by the Dead Sea, and they resurrected them out of the Jordan, and they put them in the land, and they set them up as a pillar, as a memorial forever. And they became a witness to the people. Then Jesus goes into the temple, and he gets really angry, and he makes a whip, and he casts them out, and he calls that place a den of thieves. And he pronounces judgment upon the people. And he says these words, Luke chapter 19, verse 44. He stands over the city and he pronounces judgment upon the city of Jerusalem and says, "They shall lay you to the ground, your children within thee, and they shall not leave one stone upon another. They will flatten you." Just like Jericho. And he went into the city the next day and he was hungry. And he went to a fig tree, and he looked up into the tree if he might find figs. And he found no figs up in the fig tree. And when he came, there was nothing there, and so he cursed the fig tree. And this is where, you know, on the surface you're reading this, and it's like, Jesus needs some anger management. I mean, this is like, he goes to a tree and he wants some fruit, and he doesn't find any fruit, and he says, "Right, that's it, I curse this tree." They come back out the next day and it's withered and shriveled up and there's nothing there. But of course, Jesus, whilst that seems quite an extreme thing to do, Jesus, of course, was teaching this amazing parable, wasn't he? Because he went looking for figs in Jericho and he found a big, fat, plump fig. He went looking for figs in Jerusalem and he found none. And the stark difference between what he found in Jericho and what he found in Jerusalem was in the principle of Zacchaeus. He said, "Look, half the goods I give to the poor." In Jerusalem, he went into the temple and they said, "Half of your goods you should give to me now." He found a den of thieves stealing people's money through greed. What a difference between the religious leaders and Zacchaeus. You know, of course, a fig tree that doesn't have leaves, doesn't have any fruit, is essentially a naked fig tree, isn't it? It doesn't have anything to bear. It is like a naked fig tree. And Jesus was going to next go on to the story of the woe, woe, woe. So it's the one time where he really takes the religious leaders to task and he says, "You're like whited sepulchres. You're white on the outside, but nothing inside, like dead man's bones." He says, "You're great on the outside, but inside you're rotten, like a fig tree. It's got good leaves, but no fruit." You know, Hosea chapter 9, verse 10, it says, "When I first found your fathers," when your fathers, Abraham, David, the two fathers of Israel, "your fathers were like the first figs in the first season. They were like ripe figs. That's how I first found them." Hosea goes on to say, "Your house will be left unto you desolate as well." Isn't that amazing? Son of Abraham, son of David. Where did he find people full of figs saying, "Son of David, son of Abraham"? He found it in Jericho. And God plucks out of Jericho the dirt and he makes them diamonds. And then he says to them, he tells a parable about two servants. And he says, "Which of these two servants did the father's will?" And they said to him, "The first." And Jesus says, "I tell you a truth. Tax collectors and prostitutes will go into the kingdom of God before you." Tax collectors and prostitutes. And then he says, "Because your house will be left to you desolate." Who's the first person saved out of Jericho? A prostitute. Who's the last person saved out of Jericho? A tax collector. And these two people bookend the story of the gems of Jericho, where God is able to reach down and take people that are, well, that have the worst type of baggage. We're not defined by our past. And God is able to save all of us, no matter who we are and where we're from. The key word the woman caught in the act of adultery is the fact that she was prepared to stay in her shame in the presence of the Lord. That's the story. It's not about the fact we don't make mistakes and we haven't done things in our past that are shameful. It's our ability to be able to stand in the presence of the Lord with that shame. Wanting to be purified, to be Zacchaeusified, to be made pure. Through all our defilement, through all our problems, just to be standing there in the presence of the Lord and to be able to hear, today salvation has come to this house because you are a son of Abraham. Don't you want to have that experience? You know, like, I don't know about you, but it's one of the things I actually really look forward to about the judgment seat. I want that. You know, I know it's going to be terrifying. It will be terrifying. You imagine standing before this powerful being. It'll just be absolutely terrifying. I can tell you, when you stand before him and you know him, you're going to look at the feet, aren't you? You're going to have your head bowed down and you're going to be sitting there looking at his feet. You're probably going to see some holes in it. And that's going to tell you all the story you need. He can deal with me. Lord, you can make me clean. And we will if we are prepared to go to the judgment seat willingly. We do it every day. We voluntarily go and ask the Lord to examine us, as our brother said last night. We do it Sunday by Sunday. Let a man examine himself. This process happens all the time. So if we're doing it now, we'll be able to do it at the judgment seat. And we'll be able to walk with a certain amount of confidence over our fear, because perfect love casts out fear. And we know, he will say, well done, good and faithful servant. Salvation has come into this house today because you are a son of Abraham.